The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The cosmos changes. There's no real world thing that changes. Like, you know, it makes sense to have the New Year's, you know, tonight, right around the solstice. That would, you know, mark some change. It's a New Year's Eve is a convention that we've made up that marks the changing of the calendar. But the calendar itself is just a convention. And it's been pointed out that you can go around the Bay Area and probably celebrate New Year's Eve every weekend. Because there's so many different cultures and calendars. You can go Chinese New Year's and Thai New Year's and Buddhist New Year's, and you know, it goes on and on. And so it's quite something to have all this hoopla around something that doesn't exist, except as a convention. And conventions are important because can be important, and they can also be very oppressive. But the important way conventions work is that when people share a convention, they share something in common. And so it brings people together around this common convention. And so New Year's Eve is a convention that we all kind of, most of us, have some relationship with, and it's an opportunity to come together to make something happen intentionally. Sitting together with people, practicing together with people, sharing your values during this time is a wonderful way of coming together to celebrate this convention. At New Year's Eve, we stay up until midnight. And then before that, during the retreat, we have a period of people write down some intention of something they want to cultivate for the next year or something they want to let go of. And then we'll chant the refuges and chant the precepts. And then we do this thing with this little ritual with the blessing cord. And then we sit and meditate up until way past midnight, about 4 minutes or so after midnight. And then we go to bed. So. Yesterday morning here at IMC, I gave a talk on how to evaluate your own practice. And I think that from time to time, it's useful for people to be able, who've been practicing meditation practice or Buddhist practice or any spiritual practice, to have some capacity and ability to turn around and look at themselves doing the practice and evaluate how it's going. And I went through a variety of criteria or areas which a person might look at in evaluating their practice. I'm not going to talk about that again today, but because of it's kind of on my mind, it has to do with kind of stepping back and looking at the nature of how practice unfolds for people over time. And again, evaluating it, assessing it, understanding it is an important topic, I think. So this evening, I'd like to take a little different angle at this and talk about how meditation practice, Buddhist practice, perhaps most spiritual practices, has phases to it, develops and changes over time. It's not something which is just one thing, you know, that you, generally we don't think of, I don't think of it as being one thing. It's not just one practice, do one practice and that's it. Change one way and that's it. You know, take the short path to that one particular change you're supposed to have and then live in enlightened retirement after that. There's a variety of changes that people go through as they engage in spiritual practice. And it's useful, I think, to have some sense of change. And so we can understand how to work with the changes and shift and change our practice according to the phase that we're going through. Just like there are seasons to the year, this evening we mark the change of seasons. So there are seasons, in a sense, in a person's practice. And I don't think of these various seasons or phases as being something which is set. That you're supposed to start at number one, first phase, and go to second and third and fourth, and just it's kind of a linear kind of set thing. It's much more personal and organic. Every person is going to follow their own inner development and growth in a different way than everybody else. And some people do a phase of practice early on, and that someone else might do much later on. Some people follow a particular set of phases, one after the other. Other people follow it in reverse order, or follow different ways in which it goes. And the human being is as complicated as the number of relationships you have. How many relationships do you have? You have relationships to your family, your friends, your colleagues, your neighbors, your community, your society, your the nature, the watershed you're in. You have the people in the stores, the people who produce the food and the material and goods that allow you to sustain your life, the people who receive your effluence and take care of all the things, the trash and the sewage and everything that happens. There's so many different things, the relationship to yourself. And you get a sense there's actually maybe infinite number of relationships that you're involved in. And so who are you? And one way of answering that question is that you find yourself somehow in the relationships that you have. And you change with the relationships you're involved in. In some relationships, you're a child. In other relationships, some people are parents. In some relationships, you're friends. Some relationships, you have, in your friends in different ways, your colleagues. And all these things makes you a different person in some way. It was very valuable for me when I went to the Zen monastery, where we changed jobs about every 3 months. So the turnover was quite high because, after about maybe 3 months, but maybe three times a year, average of 4 months maybe, where you would be new period of the monastery life, and we would be sometimes assigned new jobs for that new period. So for maybe 3-4 months, you'd be, when I first got there, for example, I spent 3-4 months in general, it was called general labor. Kind of just, just did whatever they said you to sent you to do anywhere. But what I did was, the primary thing I was assigned to do was sanding meditation platforms. They had this big room like this, bigger than this, and it's wooden platforms all the way around it that people sat up on, almost as high as the platform there. They had new ones that had just been made for the monastery and hadn't been installed yet and needed to be sanded. So I have my certificate in Zen training and using an electric sander. I had the virtue of being repetitive and just over and over again, me and the sander, me and the wood, looking at my mind, looking at the wood, trying to have equanimity and patience and presence and concentration and all these wonderful qualities. A lot of wood. So for 3 months, that was my job. And then I was a dishwasher. And then I was gardener. And then I was kitchen prep cook. And then I was a kitchen manager. And then I was, what was I after that? I remember what I was after that. But anyway, then you're plumber or you're treasurer or you're all these different jobs. And what was interesting about it is that people are often assigned jobs that they didn't know anything about. And so, I didn't know anything about working in the kitchen. I didn't know anything about gardening, really. I didn't know much when I went there. And there's a lot of things I didn't know much about when the jobs I was assigned to. And what I found is in each job that I had, different aspects of myself were brought out. And I was challenged in different ways. And I got to look at myself in different ways. And so if I had just had one job for a whole lifetime, if I'd only been in the kitchen a whole lifetime, some of the ways in which I was challenged would have worked through those relatively quickly, maybe, or I don't know. And I would have probably kept having challenges the rest of my life, but it would have been narrower and narrower. But by shifting to a whole different job, I was challenged in very different ways. And so it was really wonderful to have all these different challenges. So this is a long way of saying that who we are as a person, or how we what we see about ourselves and what we have to deal with in ourselves, can change a lot depending on the relationships we're in, the activity we're involved in. And to get a sense of how complex we are, I offer to you the idea that we're as complex as the number of relationships that we're in. And so, you know, even if you have very few friends, we still have a lot of relationships with different aspects of life. And so these different relationships require different parts of ourselves. And so a spiritual life that is meant to be holistic, that's meant to include all of ourselves, has to somehow address all the different relationships or all these different parts of ourselves that go into relationship with the different things. And as we go through life, there are different phases or different of ways we relate. The way the way that you relate when you're, 15 is different than when you're 25, is different than when you're 35, different when you're 45, different when you're 65. The kind of the roles you have, the position you have in society and with your people you know, it all shifts and changes. It also shifts and changes to yourself. So, also depending on your life circumstances, you might have to address different issues than other people might have to address. You might have to address different issues at different times. When I was a college student, it was the height of the Vietnam War. And so as a young freshman in college, it was basically I had to confront the issue of the draft. I was draftable. And so then I had to grapple with this whole issue of war and violence and being drafted and where I stood with that. And so that part of me in my view, had to be looked at and worked with. If there had been no war and no draft at that time, maybe I wouldn't have been shaped or I wouldn't have had to face and dealt with these kinds of large issues of war and violence and my relationship to it. I point this out that the circumstances of your time, your historical time, might also have a big impact on what you have to face and what you're working with in your spiritual life. And sometimes people, we find ourselves in situations where often where it's not our choice what our spiritual practice is about, but rather it's what circumstances provide us. So this was very clear with me when I had kids. And being very aware of new parents who had children who had a variety of very serious ailments or injuries or something, so much so that the child, for the rest of the child's life, was basically going to be someone that required the care of their parents. The parents couldn't look forward to the child growing up to be 18, 20 and leaving home, and then they can be finally free. But rather, they look forward to a child in a wheelchair or some kind of disability that had to be, you know, and so much of the parents' energy and effort, you know, the whole life kind of got centered around caring for this child. And they had to live a very different life than they ever expected. And so their spiritual practice, if they had one, had to help and support them in this major sacrifice or major limited life. And if they were going to kind of find their freedom, they had to perhaps address and look at themselves and look at issues that are very different than someone who has no limitations in their life and can just freely prance off to a monastery or go off to Asia and meditate without any concern about other people. There's very different kind of things they have to address because of that. Some people have childhood legacies that they have to deal with. A great story that I like, the story of my colleague and friend John Travis, who he was practicing in India in the 60s, late 60s, and was a wandering sadhu and Buddhist practitioner. And at some point, he felt stuck in his practice. And so back, Ramdas was there in India, and they knew each other. So he went to Ramdas and said, "You know, I'm stuck. What should I do?" And Ramdas told him, you have to go back to Kentucky to see your father. And you should go something on his terms. But don't stay long." And so John Travis went to a tailor in India and got a corduroy suit made and had his long hair cut. And went back to Kentucky and hung out with his father. And he was estranged from, worked through something there. And then at some point he felt ready to go back to India. So given his family background and how he was raised, there was something very important that he had to do about going back and meeting his father, addressing his father, doing something there. Again, in my life, I was when I was about 20 or 21, I got pretty serious about doing Zen practice. I'd been introduced to it. I thought it was really something very meaningful for me, something I wanted to pursue. So here I felt on the cusp of starting a spiritual discipline in life. And I thought, well, this is a serious thing to do. And there feels like there's some things in my life which are not, that I need to work out first before I go do those things, go do that Zen practice, throw myself into it. So I spent 3 years finishing up, silly, right, 21-year-old, finishing up loose ends, taking care of these unfinished things that I felt needed to be taken care of, some issues I had to work through or resolve for myself. And once I kind of worked through those, finished those things, those tasks that had to be completed, then I could turn my attention to the Zen practice. And then when I was about 23 or 24, I threw myself into Zen practice. And kind of never looked back. I've entered into the world of Buddhism. And the other thing about phases in practice is that we don't always know what phase we're in until we're finished with it. And you don't necessarily get to choose. So for example, my early Zen period, I was kind of all for wisdom, enlightenment. So, you know, I was huffing and puffing away for that. I didn't get much as wisdom or enlightenment. But what I got was, what happened was that slowly over time, I developed a lot of, I don't know if a lot, but I developed compassion. My sense of my capacity for compassion was awakened, developed. And so, but I didn't realize that until afterwards when I looked back at those years of practice. I said, wow, that's what the most, one of the most important things that happened for me. And I think it was a very, very important phase of my practice to open the heart, develop the capacity for compassion, for love. And perhaps it was really essential for me to do that, because only with that as a foundation could I take my own personal practice, you know, the enlightenment track, for example, further. Because you need to have a fair amount of love or open-heartedness or warm-heartedness in order to do some of the deeper work that has to happen with practice. So I kind of had this whole other thing happen to me without my, you know, recognizing it while it was happening. Some people come to spiritual practice, especially when people are quite young, and they don't know themselves well enough. They haven't had maybe enough life experience, and it's important to actually not stay in the monastery, not stay doing a lot of intensive practice, but you have to, maybe it's important to do some of it, but then leave and go out into the world and have experiences. So I saw a lot of people come through into Buddhist practice and do a few years of practice, 2 or 3 years, and just enough practice to kind of, in some ways, stabilize and find themselves and feel connected enough. And then once they found themselves enough, then they would go off to college, go to work, start a family, do something. And then they would come back, perhaps some of them, many years later, and continue. After they did this whole thing of family and work, which was maybe a very important thing for them to do, to understand themselves, to develop certain capacities, to develop skills, understandings, different kinds of things, and so that they could kind of then finally bring a certain maturity to a spiritual practice that they didn't have when they were young. Sometimes there's a phase of practice where most of practice is very personal. And it's very important to go off and be alone. Some people actually find it very, very important to go off and do solitary practice. Some people spend their life so much in relationship that they can't really find themselves unless they stop being always relating. And so they need to be alone to do that and to really spend some internal time. And it can look very self-absorbing. It can look even selfish to people outside. But they really need to deal with something inside first. And then it changes. And then there's a phase of practice where people feel that what needs to happen is much more interpersonal. And so the interpersonal realm is something that people cultivate, and they go into that. So I found it interesting after living in a Zen monastery for a few years that I became very interested in how I was in relationship to other people. In the monastery, how I was in relationship to other people wasn't that interesting for me. I was doing a lot of concentration practice, meditation practice. It was my own relationship to the Dharma, to the spiritual life, to awakening, something that was really the name of the game. But after the years of doing that, then it became a phase where the interpersonal relationships, who I was in relationship. And for example, if I was going to be free, I had to also be free interpersonally. And I got to see how there was a lot of attachments, a lot of fears, a lot of places I was stuck in my relationships to others. So for example, one thing I experimented with was I could see that I was very hesitant to let people know really what was going on with me, you know. If they found out, if I got busted. So I made it a practice for a while to be an open book. If someone asked me, so I didn't volunteer things. You're often not good to volunteer, talk about yourself too much if they don't ask. Except if you're a Dharma teacher and you can go on and have a captive audience. I don't know if it's a good idea any either, but you're still here, so. I find it very strange, this job I've got. These long monologues and people listen. There's nowhere else I go. I can just talk and talk and talk. And anywhere else, people think I was strange. So here I am, talking about myself. So I saw how hesitant I was and how afraid I was of revealing myself. So I made it a practice to be an open book. So if anybody asked me about me, I would tell them anything they asked. What do you think of that?
When's your birthday?
That was back then. You really want to know? It's July 4th. Liberation Day. What? Oh boy, this is going to take a long time. I have a number of Buddhist names. The name I was given as a Zen monk is Ryuge Kojun, which means dragon tusk. Sunlight Revere. There's two names, Dragon Tusk and Sunlight Revere. There was a famous Chinese Zen teacher named Dragon Tusk. So I think the dragon tusk part was supposed to be my ferocity, so watch out. And the sunlight, it was something I was supposed to grow into. That's what I was told by someone. And Pali name I have is Dhammadasa. And Dhammadasa means servant of the Dharma. So should I go on with the talk, or do you want to ask me now? Now you have your chance. I said, open the door for problems now.
You never talk about your mother. Never heard you mention.
No?
I've been around here 12 years. I've never heard it. So I wondered. Never mind.
I'm happy to talk about my mother, but I don't know if it makes sense for anybody else to hear. So there's this phase, interpersonal phase, where you know, so experimenting, finding out what it was like and what happened, with you know, just being more open to people as they asked me. It was a very, very useful thing I did, exercise I did. There was also relationships I had with people, like I found it very interesting to work with the relationships I had with some of my teachers. And there were some teachers, there was one teacher in particular who I had a lot of perhaps projection or transference issues with, and saw as a great authority figure, and was somewhat intimidated about being around this teacher. And so it was my task, I felt, to figure out how to be able to meet the teacher as an equal. And what would it take? What did I have to face in myself and deal with myself and look at myself, and what kind of inner strength I had to cultivate, what did I have to let go of, so that I could kind of work with this teacher so we can meet. And I was a little bit helped by the with that idea, this was important. Because in Zen, they have an idea that practice is not only something you do personally, but it's also a matter of becoming a Buddha yourself. But you only become a Buddha, really, if you become a Buddha with someone else. Buddha to Buddha, they say, face to face. And so it's a matter of somehow, something about the purity or the directness or the wakefulness of two people meeting that's considered to be very important. So you had to meet somehow as an equal in some way in order to kind of let that relationship come to fruition. So that was a phase where I found that very useful to deal with those kinds of issues that sometimes are considered maybe more psychological. Then there, some people's are can be phases where it seems like what's important in practice is to be of service. And so after receiving a lot of benefits from doing a practice for oneself, it feels like it's really important to turn it outwards and offer support to other people. Some people will practice for a long time in a very personal way before they do a phase of service phase. Some people find that what works best for them is to start with service phase and to actually spend the first years of practice doing just a lot of support and help and as faith-oriented help. And that does something to the heart, it does something to the mind, it develops certain qualities. That's how they develop some of the things that are important. Many years ago, I taught a retreat somewhere in a place in the Midwest. And when I came back, I received a letter from the organizer of the retreat and said that he wanted me to intervene somehow because he was really troubled. They'd put on a lot of retreats over the years, and there was one person who always came to the retreats. But the person was not making any progress. And would I, from a distance somehow, do something about this problem? Or what should be done about this problem, this person not making progress? Well, I remember meeting the person, a nice person, but I was only there for one retreat, so I didn't really know the person that well enough to know about how the person changed over time. But I wrote back saying, I didn't really feel like I was in a position to offer advice, but that you had to be careful about how you measure progress. Because you don't know what's needing to be developed in someone's heart, in someone's mind. It could be that for whatever reason, there might be very personal reasons, where the person needs to cultivate and develop for years sometimes, is their faith. Faith is a very valuable asset and very important, or confidence, or inspiration, or their love of the Dharma, or their love of awakening or practice. And it's not a matter of, you know, becoming more awakened or practicing, you know, in conventional ways of developing more meditation practice or concentration and these kinds of things, but rather it's the whole faith side that needs to be awoken. And sometimes people will show up and be around a Dharma scene for years, come to retreats and do all this, and what's really something very important is cultivating, mellowing, ripening, and when the faith, if it's faith, at some point their faith can be so ripened that they're ready to sit down and be still. And then they can go fast. There are other people who might not have much faith, much confidence, much inspiration, exactly. But they hear a teacher who says, oh, if you're really serious about this practice, you have to sit down, close your eyes, focus on your breath, get concentrated, and if you really do this well, you'll be liberated. And so they sit down, but somehow the faith hasn't really ripened. The sense of somehow their heart's heartfeltness that needs to be part of it isn't really there. The sense of surrender, perhaps, or the softening that can happen with faith is not there. And so they were like me when I was young, huffing and puffing with my breath, you know, trying to make something happen. Sometimes people can, it just doesn't work. They hit a kind of a brick wall, and sometimes they leave spiritual practice entirely because they were given the wrong instruction. And so you need to be very respectful and careful about evaluating yourself, but also other people, about what they're doing, what's cultivating, what's working, what's really happening with them and their practice, their life. You don't want to kind of shoehorn everyone into a set mold of what spiritual practice, Buddhist practice looks like, or what phase a person's in. Because there's so many different things that are going on at different times for people that you have to kind of be very sensitive to what's going on. As a teacher, then, one of my jobs is to try the best I can to understand what people's intentions are. Hopefully their intention is what they need to follow. And so they support the intention they have. The intention is to do deep interpersonal solitary kind of practice to support that if that's appropriate. If what's important is to do a service, go off and offer some service, be a hospital chaplain, then I'll support them to do that. If what they're to do is to a phase of life where they should study. Like for me, I spent 10 years, basically 10 years of my life in Buddhist monastic settings without leaving, doing intensive practice. And then that phase came to a conclusion, came to an end. And the next phase I felt at the time was I felt I needed to study Buddhism for a while. Because in the monastery, you didn't get to study very much. You got to practice a lot. But in terms of reading the sutras and the history of Buddhism, I hadn't done that. And it seemed like I was starting to kind of, people were starting to expect me or ask me to be a teacher. And I didn't feel like I was ready. I felt like I needed to study and understand Buddhism better. So there was a phase of my life where I studied Buddhism to be better prepared to be a teacher. So sometimes people come to me and they want to study. That's the phase they're in. One of the values that I got from studying at university, Buddhism in university, like at Stanford, was a certain kind of intellectual liberation, freedom. It's very easy for, I was kind of chastened, is the right word, humbled, when I was an undergraduate, because as an undergraduate I studied, I was really into being, studying organic farming. And I was a kind of born again organicist, organist fundamentalist. And then I took these science classes, soil science classes, and science of what happens. And I was surprised to learn that some of my cherished organic beliefs weren't true. And I was kind of chastened that I had these kind of strong, kind of held beliefs about what was true when I actually didn't know. So when I got involved in religious practice, I had this guess, this suspicion, that religious people, as a kind of generalization, are more prone to generalizations, are more prone to kind of say, this is what's true, than farmers are. And so I said, I don't want to do this again. I think I need to learn, have the skill and the ability to understand and look at my beliefs, question them, look at what's underlying assumptions that support them, so I don't end up doing the same thing with Buddhism. And so part of the value of, for me, of the intellectual study was to help me free myself from that tendency, or try to free myself from that tendency of this kind of, so I call it intellectual liberation. You know, it's, maybe that was a kind of peculiar trait of mine that I needed that phase. So I said, so one thing as a teacher is to listen to people's intention. Ask them, you know, what do you want? What kind of spiritual practice are you engaged in right now? Excuse me. It's also a matter of listening more deeply than what you think is your intention, what you think your practice should be about, or what you want your practice to be about. But sometimes there's something deeper going on that's maybe deeper than what your surface mind can recognize. So how do you discern what that is? How do you find that? Sometimes it's intuitive. You find a strong intuitive pull towards going in some direction. So as I told you, this phase of my own practice where compassion was really important, maybe being developed, without it being conscious, a choice, I kept gravitating towards images, people, situations that were somehow that embodied compassion. So there was this kind of orientation that kept happening. Something inside of me knew that that's what I should focus on, even though I didn't know. Something inside of me that wasn't me was deciding. So sometimes you have to listen to that. And so one of the things we can ask and practice is not so much what we want, but what's being asked of us. What's our heart asking us to do, as opposed to what the mind is telling us to do. And that's one of the values of getting quiet, is so we can listen quietly. And if we get very quiet and listen to the heart or something intuitive inside and see what's being asked of us. what needs to develop now? What needs to happen now? If you're near the end of your life, which sometimes we don't know when is, but you know, if you're getting to be old, is it okay to say that some people are old? Or is that no longer correct? Not that any of you are old. But someday, if you're lucky enough, you'll be old. And at some point you come to this magic turning point in your life. Some people, it's when they're 45, 50, I don't know when it is, 55, 60, 65. Some people wait until they're 105. But when you realize, wait a minute, I can see the end in sight. Like, you know, I don't have endless time anymore. You know, if I was 20, I could imagine going back to school and getting a law degree. I can imagine going, you know, doing this. But, you know, I'm 65 and or 75, and I don't think, even though I'm interested in doing that, you know, it just doesn't make sense anymore. Sometimes people do that, and we're inspired. But, you know, the priorities shift and change. And so when we get a sense of the end, priorities change, and different things become important. And so a phase of life, phase of practice, then has a lot to do with that sense of finiteness or mortality or end, or since if I'm going to do this important thing, I have to do it now. And so then that can inform the phase we're in. But if you're young, if you're 20 or 21, then sometimes it's useful to kind of have a kind of wider panorama, since, well, I'm probably going to be doing this for the next 20, 30 years, some way or other. And so, yeah, so it maybe makes sense to go to school. Maybe it makes sense to do these finish these unresolved things, work on my issues with my parents, perhaps. You know, sometimes if you're, you know, 85 and know you only have a few months to live, certain issues that you had earlier on kind of lose their strength anymore. It doesn't become so important to face them in the way it was important maybe when you were younger. So, that was my attempt to suggest to you that spiritual life, Buddhist life, goes through all kinds of phases. And some of them are cyclic. We repeat and revisit some of them. Some of them we go through once, we don't go through again. Sometimes a phase can be very dramatic. Some people can have very deep realization experiences very early on and then become a mess because they have all this unresolved stuff that they haven't worked on yet, they haven't dealt with. And other people who do work on all the unresolved stuff first, and for years, 20, 30 years, say, why am I so slow? My friends are getting these deep experiences and I'm not. But then after doing all this inner work, then they're more prepared, and then they can have some more dramatic transformation that maybe something happens. There's so many ways in which this unfolds. It's very important that you, each of you, are very, very respectful. Respectful to the point of maybe loving yourself. And really appreciating, respecting, loving that you have your own way. And your own way represents, you know, your own way, you know, has a lot to do with how all these different relationships, all these different issues in life come together and meet you in this juncture of now. So don't look for other people as fixed models of how it should be for you. There might be other models of what might inspire you and point you in directions and support you, but the only person who can really know what phase you're in is you. So I hope you find your way. I hope it's profoundly meaningful and liberating. And before you're enlightened, may you all... It would be nice if you were compassionate. But if the compassionment comes after the enlightenment, that's fine too. Thank you.